Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's the My First Gig Podcast. Whoa. Sharing stories of first gigs and shows. Comedians sharing their memories. The fun and entertaining, exciting and crazy. With Dwayne Dugan as your host. It's the My First Gig Podcast. Here we go.
Hello. Can you let me talk? Excuse me? Hello and welcome to the My First Gig Podcast. I am your host, Dwayne Dugan. Thank you so much for joining me today. Once again, here to hopefully break up your week, break up the boredom, break up the ever looming insanity. I began using the series number as like a direction on how far we've been in this. So this is series 2, episode 6. So I'm like, oh, we're 6 weeks in. And I'm not sure if that means I should think that, oh, has it been 6 weeks already, or should this actually be episode 45, you know? Do you know those socks that you have with the days on them? Now, I have a load of those. As I've said in previous episodes, I'm in my mother's house for all of this. There's a box of socks here that I haven't had in like 10 years, and I only came down for a few days, so I'm like running out of socks and jocks. And I just put on the random pair of socks that I haven't touched in 10 years, and it said Saturday. And I looked at my phone, and it was Saturday. And I actually felt proud and an achievement. Like those, I'm sure there's people out there who have the socks and they put the right ones on every day, and my God, I would go insane. Not sure whether that's mental or organized, but whatever little line between the two would drive me crazy. But like, it actually gave me a bit of a pickup. I'm like, there we go. Not everything's dreadful. I have correct socks on. So even now, saying it out loud, I'm like, no, you are mental. You're going insane. The podcast isn't saving you. My guest today is none other than Tom Rhodes. Tom Rhodes has been around forever, standing the test of time now in his fifth decade of comedy, starting out in the 80s. Appearances on Jay Leno, Comedy Central, The Joe Rogan Experience, and everything in between. Tom's no stranger to gigging here in Ireland. An absolute favourite almost every year at the comedy festivals here. I had the pleasure of hosting, I think it was the last show of the Vodafone Comedy Festival. You've heard me mention it before. It's the only thing we have in Ireland to look forward to, and there's been no official announcement, but due to the restrictions, it's not going to go ahead this year, and I'm very sad. But last year at the Vodafone Comedy Festival, I hosted the final show of the weekend in one of the tents there, and Tom was on the bill. First time meeting Tom, great gigging with Tom. It was Tom Rhodes, Ashley Bentley, a local here, Joanne McNally, and Cameron Esposito. And then, of course, the world-famous podcaster Dwayne Dugan as the MC. Always the MC, never the bridesmaid. It was great to catch up with Tom again to talk his first ever gig. I'm sitting here, as you may have heard me being interrupted at the top, by my assistant here, Kitty, my cat Kitty. She's asleep here next to me, and I've just realised tomorrow is the last day of her teens. So today's Wednesday, tomorrow Thursday when recording. On Friday, she turns 20 years old. And that's not in cat years, that's in human years. In cat years, I think she's approaching 102, 106, you know, so she's pretty old. She's enjoying a nice snooze now. She loves her snoozes, but like if you were 106, you'd do nothing but sleep either. But she still finds time to interrupt me in the podcast. Let's see how she's getting on. She's having a nice time now. So I was 12 when we first got her. So I've got a brother and sister, Katie and Pierce. And Katie is 15 years old and Pierce is 12. 15 and 12, yeah. So like, Katie's been in my life longer than everybody. My longest friend I didn't meet till I was 12, later that year. Not that I didn't have any friends when I was 12. We just moved around a lot. And now I only have like 6 friends. And the one I've known for the longest, I've known for 20 years. But not yet. We would have met in September. So, Kitty, yeah, you've been around the longest. Her name wasn't always Kitty. Like, granted, you're thinking Kitty's a weird name for a cat. Well, no, it's a very suitable name for a cat. It's, I guess, a bit typical. But a couple of months before that, we got our second cat. My first ever cat was called Oscar. He was a fat, grumpy old man. And we got him when we were still living in London. So I would have been like 8 years old. And he went missing for ages. We lived on a busy road down in southeast London. And he came back eventually. And he was walking funny. And we realised his tail was like really dragging. And like not going up and down. We took him to the vets and we were like, oh yeah, like his tail is disconnected from his body. It must have been like, they assume it was like a car ran over his tail. Which like was tremendously painful. So, you know, they cut off the fur and the bone, and he went around there and just with a little stump, and then the stump would go up and down, and he was happy out. But when we moved back to Ireland, I went to live with my nan for a while my mother got settled in Cork, and so Oscar came and lived with us, and then I moved down, but we weren't allowed to have pets, so we were waiting, and then we got the news that Oscar had passed away, and probably maybe 15 years later, I'm told that everybody in the family seems to believe, I don't know if I can say this truthfully, but seems to believe that my nan killed Oscar. Not maliciously, but she didn't like him. So no smoke without fire. Hit him with a car. We're led to believe. So then we got a cat then later, little kitten, brand new, called Kitty. She was mental. She used to sit on the back of the couch on like the head rest. Mum paid to have her neutered, paid to have all her, whatever you do when you get a brand new cat. And then it just ran away straight away. Like, first time it's allowed outside, gone. Off we go. So we went and got a new cat, another little baby. She's brand new. Call her Dot. But it's very hard to call Dot out the back door. You can't go out and go, Dot, Dot. I mean, maybe you can, but it's just Dot, Dot. So I just ended up keeping on calling her Kitty. Because she looked exactly the same. Brown tabby. All my cats have been brown tabbies. Short hair. Love them. And yeah, she was the best. And she's still here. And we've been very lucky. She's still very healthy. Like, you know, when I tell people that she's nearly 20, they don't believe it because she looks so young and she's got a bit of energy in her and she jumps up and down and runs around. And she's not as, you know, she has slowed down in years, but she's not what you're picturing when you picture a 20-year-old cat, you know. And even the vets and everybody, they're saying like, here, look, she defies the odds. I remember the biggest issue that we had was, I think my mother was in Australia and I was in Dublin, and I came back from Dublin and we were going to go collect the cat from the vets. The vets also have like a place there to like mind animals, like a kind of a kennel or a cattery, or did I make up the word cattery? So she'd been there for a little couple of weeks, you know, a kind of quite a long stay for her. And we went down and my mum's friend and my aunt were with me to come collect her. And we went in, got her from the vets, so happy to see her, bringing her out to the car, put the door on the cat box was loose, flies open, she jumps out, she doesn't know where she is, she's terrified, she hops up on a wall and goes into back gardens of houses, and it's like, that's it, she's gone forever. I'm searching, trying to jump up on the walls, running around, trying to see, no sign, she's gone, she could be anywhere. There's a busy roundabout, there's, you know, it's not this little quiet, there's just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of houses, back gardens, trees, everything. And then just finally, when we're really worried that she's gone, you just hear this tiny little meow. She's terrified, doesn't know where she is. Answers the call, get her back in the box, and she jumps in the box this time. She wanted to escape the first time. Now she's like, oh, look, maybe I should be in here for a reason. But other than that, she's been great, and she's having a little sleep now. And yeah, Friday, May 1st. On the 1st of May, she'll turn 20 years old, so happy birthday, Kitty. Nah, she's asleep. On the 1st day of May, she was breaking away when the moon came and sat on your shoulder. She was still young, not yet highly strong, as she needs to be when she gets older. I am losing my mind singing poetry to a cat. I'm going to go away, introduce an episode, while I go and bake the best cat cake. How about you sit here and tune in to My First Gig with Tom Rhodes.
Oh man, I'm fantastic. My mother was visiting me a month ago when all this stink ball of virus hit, and we decided she should stay here with me and ride it out. Otherwise, I would have been alone in Los Angeles, and she'd have been alone in Florida. So I love and adore my mother, and I'm happy to be looking out for her. And then also, I would have been, I think, more casual in my attitude about going out if she hadn't have been here. But because she's of advanced age, I kind of do a combat preparedness when I go out. I got my little chemical mask. I got some little black tight chemical gloves and, you know, really wash shit down when I get back, make her wait in the other room, throw the laundry in the machine, jump in the shower. You know, it's like, you know, real hardcore precaution.
Well, it's doing what we hoped everybody be doing.
Washing their ass better.
But that's nice. I'm the same. I'm down in my mother's house. I came down to visit basically, you know, before things got shut down, and then got shut down while I was here. But it's nice. It's probably, you know, it's the longest that I've spent visiting in the last 10 years. So it's positives in it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of great things. I mean, for me anyway, like kind of similar. My mother and I usually only get a week at a time together.
Hmm.
When I go visit her in Florida or she comes to visit me. And this is kind of nice to have the unabridged time with my mother. And then also, I think it's a really good time to be able to hug your mother during all this.
There's all these horror stories of, you know, not being able to go visit family, or if you do, it's like through a glass or anything like that. So,
yeah, and I think even a lot of mentally well-adjusted people are having a difficult time. I think the mental clusterfuck for a lot of people who are either alone or trapped with somebody they don't like. Like, you know, I read that domestic violence is up, and they were predicting a great baby boom from all this, but a more accurate assessment I read was there'll probably be a great divorce boom after this. I think people realize if they're with the wrong person that they really need to get their life in a different position, you know?
Yeah, like I think everyone's prioritizing now, or will reprioritize what's going on. When did kind of lockdown happen over there? Like, we're talking like 14, 15 of March, I think it was it?
Well, you know, I'm in California. California was way ahead of the rest of the country.
Okay.
So they canceled everything on March 13th, which was the Friday the 13th. All the comedy clubs in Los Angeles got shut. Everything got shut. You know, they said no nightclubs, no restaurants, no bars. So I think it was that week. It was somewhere. But we were in California. They had made the lock. I think that's when they made the whole state lockdown. A couple days or a week before they had locked down San Francisco.
How are you finding not performing and not working as regularly as you're used to?
Well, you know, the good thing for me is, you know, I'm normally on the road at least 2 weeks a month.
Yeah.
And I've wanted to spend more time at home. So it's actually kind of nice not to be going to the airport every week or every other week to go fly somewhere and do shows. And fortunately for me, I'm editing my next album.
Oh, very nice.
Which my last album was Around the World, where I recorded it in 24 cities around the world. It took me 2 years to record it. It starts in Paris, ends in Jerusalem. I got Dublin, Galway, and Belfast on the Around the World album. But last year I did this theater tour of England, Ireland, and Scotland, and I'm editing that right now. And that album is going to be called The Honky Motherland.
Okay.
And it's really nice to be I'm listening to these shows every day, and it's really pretty beautiful to hear, even though I can't perform right now, I'm really enjoying hearing the roar of these theater crowds when like a laugh really hits. So I'm kind of getting my fix that way.
That's very nice. Yeah, it's amazing how like separated it can be, even just after, you know, it's been a month and a couple of days, and simple things like even just hearing a crowd together might sound odd, or in other ways, nice and comforting.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Like I think a lot of things are going to change. I think a lot of great things are going to come out of this. I'm an eternal optimist. But I think it's a good time for everyone in the world to recalibrate and reassess the things that are important in their life. But the point I'm trying to make is, like, when September 11th happened, I was living in Amsterdam. So, like, the world kind of freaked out. I remember what Europe was like after that. But that was really, like, kind of like the collective experience of the United States, like the changes that really happened and what people were experiencing. The thing about this experience, the unique thing about this is that everyone in the world is experiencing this exact same collective experience together. So, like, everybody in the world is on lockdown. My mother's from Argentina. She's been talking to family there. I've been talking to friends of mine around the world, and everybody is, you know, locked in their little abodes and hovels. And, you know, I think that we'll see how everybody's going to, how this is going to react in the comedy world. And, like, it is kind of unique that everybody has the same experience. And I think it's kind of an epoch in time. I'm excited to go back, and I'm excited to recreate the next phase in my life, because everybody is going to be recreating the next phase in their life.
It's hard to predict, but I'm going to take your optimistic look and go, yeah, I think it's going to be exciting what's happening next. We're going to talk about your first ever gig, first ever time on stage tonight. But before we do, I want to ask you, if I say to you, what's your first memory of comedy, what comes to mind for you?
Richard Pryor. My father was a huge Richard Pryor fan, and my dad loved stand-up, but Pryor was his dude. And my dad had tons of Richard Pryor records. I remember we had vinyl records. My dad loved Pryor and Bob Newhart. So I remember we had those vinyl records in the house. But my dad had, I don't remember if they were cassettes or even 8-tracks, but I remember driving around with my dad as a little kid and my dad listening to Richard Pryor. So my first comedy memory is being a little kid. And, you know, like, you didn't have to wear seatbelts back then. And I remember when I was like 4 or 5 driving with my dad, I would actually stand next to him and I would have my arm around my dad as he drove, you know, no seatbelt on. If we'd had gotten a car accident, I'd have been killed against a windshield or gone through the windshield. But I remember driving around in my dad with my dad listening to these Richard Pryor tapes. And, you know, I didn't understand a lot of the adult themes and stuff like that. But the thing that hit me as a kid was when Pryor would animate animals. Like, he did the thing about his girlfriend broke up with him, and then the dog came up and talked to him on the way out and said, you know, hey, Rich, it's been cool, but you were a little tardy with the food and left a little something for you to remember me by behind the couch. And then there was the thing with the monkey in the backyard and the neighbor's dog. And then when he went to Africa, he like animated like how the cheetahs were when they were running. So that's the thing. When I was a kid, I remember that was the thing that I loved the most about Pryor, was the way he would animate animals and give them a voice. So that's really my first comedy memory, is driving around with my dad listening to Richard Pryor.
So stand-up's been, like, you've been aware of stand-up as almost as long as you can remember.
Yeah, my whole life. And so my dad took me, my family's originally from Washington, D.C. And my uncle tried to do open mic night comedy for 1 year in D.C. 1978, I was 11 years old. And my dad took me to see him. And it was at a club called El Brookman's. It was the first place to do stand-up. Like club to do stand up in Washington, D.C. And the entrance was next to the stage. And the show was in progress when we entered. And I was wearing a Washington Redskins jacket. That's the football team of D.C. And the comedian on stage grabbed me, pulled me on stage, and he interviewed me like I was the coach of the Redskins. And I was 11 years old, and I just gave little bashful, dopey, 11-year-old kid one-word answers like, yes, no. But I'll never forget standing on that stage and seeing all those happy people with their heads thrown back in laughter and all the teeth in their mouth. And I know I've romanticized the memory, but in my mind, it was all of humanity. There were black people, there were Latino people, there were Asians, there was every kind of flavor of humanity laughing in this, you know, club. So my idea of stand-up was that when you're on that stage, you're talking to the world. So from, you know, and then we sat at the bar and I remember sipping Cokes and watching all the comedians that night. And it just seemed like this magical world where these guys were like wizards. They could get up there with words and ideas and like make this whole room full of people laugh. So from that moment onward, I never wanted to do anything else with my life. And I became a student of stand-up comedy. Like Saturday Night Live was on. I remember staying up late watching SNL on Saturdays. Johnny Carson was back then, was on nightly during the weekdays. And he always had stand-up comedians on. Whenever there was a stand-up comedian on the talk shows, I'd be sitting in front of the television. HBO had these hour specials. So that's another thing I did with my dad. My dad and I would get excited whenever there was an hour special by a comedian, and we watched all of them, and we would talk about, you know, what we liked that the comedian did, what we didn't like, you know, we really analyzed them together.
That's interesting, because like, I guess at that age, to get that experience, and from a young age, you've been listening to these tapes and hearing these cassettes and stuff like that. I'm thinking now, from that moment at 11 or 12, you didn't want to do anything else with your life. How important do you think it was that your uncle was doing this, that I guess for someone that age, for you to realize that it was something that you could do later on? Because I guess if he wasn't there, it might have been so a bit too far-fetched or something like that in a child's mind.
Well, he didn't stick with it, but it definitely was the... You know, and I'm seeing these people doing it on television. I saw the people do it at the club. And, you know, when you're 11 years old, you're not thinking about money and what careers, you know, is banking going to be better than comedy? I wasn't, you know, I just thought these people were magic wizards and everything in comedy. I mean, I got into Monty Python. I remember this was before cable television. I mean, there was this fourth channel. You had the three main channels, and then there was this fourth channel. And at night, they would show Benny Hill reruns, which, you know, when you're, you know, it's always good to see, you know, large-breasted women be chased by a pervert. But more importantly, after Benny Hill, they showed the Dave Allen Show. And I remember watching Dave. I thought Dave Allen was a genius. I thought he was like kind of the James Bond of comedy. He always had a cocktail and a cigarette. And then they showed Monty Python's Flying Circus on that same channel. And, you know, comedy movies, anything that had to do with comedy, if I could get my hand on a book or a magazine article, I had to read about it. Even if it was a comedian I didn't like, it was my path that I wanted to take.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Obviously, at 12 years old, you're not ready to step on that path yet. So, like, how long does it take you to go and actually start to perform then, or what you have to do to reach that level?
Well, when I was 12, my family moved to Orlando, Florida. Actually, we moved to Oviedo, Florida, which is it used to be a small citrus farming village outside of Orlando. But Orlando grew up, it expanded, and they built a circular highway around it. And now my charming citrus village is a highway exit with Target and, you know, Chili's and Burger King and all that other kind of stuff. And the orange groves are no longer. But when I lived there, the high school that I went to was pretty small, and everybody knew that I wanted to be a comedian. So I got to do everything. Whenever I got to do the morning and afternoon announcements, like in 11th and 12th grade, I got to host all of the pep rallies and the talent shows. So I was like, I was always working on jokes, and I was always keeping notebooks and writing funny ideas and joke ideas. So I really was lucky at my high school that I got to do. And then most importantly, I have to say, I had this this beautiful man, greatest teacher I've ever had, black and gay. He was the drama and speech teacher, Mr. Martin, and guy. He used to wear purple suede boots. What a cool guy. He gave me the first five, there was a little stage in his class, and he gave me the first 5 minutes of every class to do my stand-up routine. So the deal was that I made with him was he would give me the first 5 minutes to do a little monologue, and then I'd give the class back to him, and he told me if I ever interrupted him in his class, he would take that privilege away from me. So I was the most well-behaved pupil in his class, because he gave me this stage time, and it was great. I got to work on jokes. So my high school really, because it was a little country farmer high school, I got to get all this great stage time. And then a comedy club opened up in Orlando. And when I was 17, on February 4th, 1984, I went to do my first open mic night at the, it was called the Funny Farm at the time.
So you're definitely not a shy child anyway, and you're well used to getting up in front of people. The Funny Farm opens up. Do you hear about the Funny Farm instantly when you're 17, or does it open up shortly before? Like,
I think maybe it had been open for 6 months or a year when I heard about it.
And like, once you hear about it, is that in your mind, you're like, right, this is it, this is my chance, I'm off to do this?
Well, you had to be 21 to get into the clubs, and right. I was 17 years old. So my first thought was, how do I get a hold of a fake ID? So in Florida at the time, back then, when you got your driver's license, they gave you a pink slip in case you lost your driver's license, so you could have it, replaced. So my older brother let me take his pink slip, and he really drilled me on his personal information. I had to memorize his birth date, his social security number, all this shit, and I went in. And it, usually a fake ID has been doctored somehow, but this was an actual legal state government document with my picture on it, and it was flawless. So I got, well, actually, my dad drove me to my first open mic night because I didn't have a car, but I had that fake ID, and, you know, basically, my career started as a crime, but but it was great because, I mean, I was 17. It was going to be 4 more years until I was going to be able to get into clubs. So I started out as a comedian when I was 17 because I had this this fake ID that was indisputable.
So you hear about this club, you get your ID. Like, do you call up the club? Do you go down to check it out? What? How do you go about getting on stage?
I called them first, and I remember you had to be put on the list. And they put me on the list, and they said they'd give me 5 minutes for like my first open mic. And, you know, when you're starting out, I made a couple of props. I had a couple of props that I did. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I just was trying to be funny any way I could. So I remember I made two of the props in art class. One of them was a school crossing sign that I had a stupid joke for. There was another joke, this show called Family Feud.
Yeah.
Richard Dawson was this English guy, and he was kind of a drunk and a pervert. He'd be like flirting with the moms on this show. I did like and when you get an answer wrong, it's like goes, eh, and there's like a red X. So I painted a red X on a piece of plexiglass. And I remember I did my impression of Richard Dawson at a bar, like trying to hit on a girl. And, you know, it was just stupid. And then what was oh my God. Then this other one I did, is it like a Kotex, like the maxi pad? I remember I stole it out of my mom's bathroom. I did my impression of Mr. T, who was popular in 1984. And, it was just silly, but it took me my first, I did this other thing where I drew a UPC code on my stomach. The joke was, it was just a dumb joke, but it was just funny that I took a Sharpie marker and I drew on my stomach. So I think it was probably the first two or three gigs, open mic nights that I did where I had these props. And then I realized I don't need to be carrying around props and shit. I watched what the other guys were doing and thought it was much cooler to not have props. But for my first open mic night, I think for 2.5 of my 5 minutes, I had a little prop to go with the joke.
You say you've been performing at the top of class every day and you're waiting all this time, you know, for years, this is what you want to do. You finally get told, right, here's your 5 minutes. How do you go about either deciding what goes into that 5 minutes or condensing stuff into 5 minutes? Or you probably had too much you wanted to say, I'd say, in that first time getting up there.
Yeah, I mean, I had time to prepare, but the difference was I was telling jokes in the high school for teenagers, and I knew I was going to the adult world. So, you know, I was nervous about that. I mean, you know, and I only had teenage experiences at the time. I don't think I did this on my first open mic night, but it was a really early joke that I did that always got a laugh. And I think my first year of doing stand up, it was probably like my strongest joke. But I told the story about I was on a date with a girl. And we're parking after the date and we're making out and kissing. And I made my big move. I unbuttoned her pants and she grabbed my wrist and she pushed my hand away. And she said, if I do anything with you, what's it gonna mean? And I said, well, for you, a ride home. Which, you know, I mean, come on, it's, you know, from 2020 perspective, it was a very sexist and, milk pig thing to say. But in 1984, when you're scraping to find something funny to tell an adult audience, that joke was a killer and it worked every time.
Do you remember the day, you know, you say you got a lift up there from your dad. Do you remember the day knowing that, right, you're going to finally get up on stage in front of an audience yourself?
Yeah, no, I mean, it consumed my life. Like I said, I even in art class came up with some, that's where I made the props, was in my art class. So it consumed every waking moment. I couldn't wait to do it. And I was terrified and excited and the adrenaline pumping through my body, I'll never forget. There's nothing like it's like the first time you have sex. It's like, you know, you want to be as good as you can and last as long as you can. And I remember being absolutely terrified and then getting on stage and realizing that the spotlight was brighter than I had anticipated. And then that's, you know, something you got to adjust to. But it felt like being on a roller coaster because, like, as terrifying as it was, the moment I got off that stage, I couldn't wait to get back on and ride that again and have that experience again.
So, yeah, obviously it went well that night.
Yeah, and then it was kind of cool too, because that local club, which like I think the next year they changed the name to the Copa Banana, which is still one of the worst names for a comedy club ever. It was only local comedians. So there was like two guys that were the local stars, and then the rest of them were pretty much open mic night level. But the great thing about it was local comedians, and there was kind of a purity to it that nobody really knew, you know, how it should be going. There wasn't like the headliner comedian coming in like there were other comedy clubs around America. What they would do was they would have a comedian and then a skit, and then a comedian, skit, comedian, skit, comedian, skit. So every Monday they would do rehearsals, and you were encouraged to bring in a skit that you had written. And then you'd get to act in other people's skits. So it was actually kind of cool that, you know, and then once I got in, you know, I stopped doing all the high school things. I stopped going to football games. I stopped going to the dances, because every weekend, once I got in with this club, after like my second open mic night, I think they asked me to be a regular. I got to go to this comedy club every weekend. So not only did I get to do my little 10-minute set every week or every Friday and Saturday, but I got to be in an act in a skit. Like there would be like parodies of commercials, different things like that. And I really found that really, there was an earnestness to the whole thing. Because nobody knew what they were doing, that we had no rules and no guidelines.
It's what you always wanted and what you'd been waiting so long for. And now here it is, you know, coming to life, and you're a big part of it.
Yeah. And I remember a skit that I wrote that I brought in and I got to do. 1984, Boy George was really big. And Florida was a pretty redneck place back then. And people of ambiguous genders were not, I remember I saw the B-52s open for The Who at the Tangerine Bowl in Orlando. And these rednecks in Orlando, they not only booed them off the stage, they threw their shoes at them. So the B-52s cut their set short because they were performing in a hailstorm of thrown shoes. So that should give you an idea of how Central Florida felt about Boy George also. So I did this character called Boy Tom, and I had taken a Twister board, you know, the little cloth.
Yeah.
Board game for Twister. It's got all the big brightly colored circles. So I cut a head hole and I made a dress out of it. And I did this. I'm a comedian. I tell the jokes. Something along those lines.
Fantastic.
But I mean, it was just fun, and it was cooler than, you know, hanging out with high school kids every weekend. I enjoyed, you know, and then also like, God, Florida in the 80s, it was so much cocaine. In that first year or so, like people would come up, if they thought you did a good set, they'd shake your hand and there'd be like a folded up dollar with like a gram of coke in it. And I mean, I was still playing baseball in high school and I was terrified of drugs. So whenever that happened to me, I would give my little folded up dollar with a gram of cocaine to the older comedians. So they all loved me.
I want to go back to that first night. It must have been cool having your dad there, you know, having, I guess, spent so many years listening to stand-up and him introducing you to stand-up and being a big fan himself, to have him there your first time on stage.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I really credit my father with, you know, he's the reason I'm a comedian. And that was really great, because after the show, and then he drove me to my second open mic night too. And I remember driving home with him and talking about, you know, what worked and what didn't work, and, you know, mistakes I made, and just how to correct it, and how to, you know, stay focused and cool like a gunfighter and not let certain things jangle your nerves when you're up there, you know? And like, oh, that joke didn't work. That's probably best to drop that one. And oh, that one really worked. And, you know, things like that.
Do you remember any of the names of the people who were around at the time, or if any of them kind of, did you keep up with any of them as the years passed?
I remember every one of them, and none of them still do comedy.
If I could take you today, take you back to the Funny Farm right before you're about to go on stage, if you could take yourself aside and have a minute or two with you, what do you think you'd say if you had a moment to speak with yourself?
Well, you know, it's the same advice I would give any young comedian. Don't be so hard on yourself. I think a lot of comedians are perfectionists, and a lot of comedians beat themselves up, especially in your first 10 years of being a comedian. You know, you could have a great set and then like you're unhappy because one or two jokes didn't work. Oh, well, that thing didn't work, or the new thing I'm trying didn't come out of my mouth properly. I think the best thing you can do is be your own best friend. And how are best friends? They're nice to each other. They don't make each other feel shitty. So you got to be your own best friend in this business. And the thing that I always say, great advice that I always give people, is you really have to be your own Bundini Brown. Bundini Brown was Muhammad Ali's corner man. Bundini Brown is the guy who came up with the float like a butterfly, sting like a bee poem. And he was Muhammad Ali's corner man for his entire career. So you need to be that guy in your own mind for your own self as a comedian. And he's not saying you suck. He's telling you to stay off the ropes. You're the champ. Keep jabbing, champ. Throw a haymaker. Stay in there. Stay focused. You're the champ. You don't belong on the floor. You belong, you know, throwing your heaviest artillery and punches and stuff. So your first open mic night, it's the great thing. Everybody experiences the same thing. There's no shortcuts for any comedian. It's terrifying. And you just have to go on and get that first time out of your way. I mean, I think I was terrified for the first 5 years I was a comedian. But I wanted to be a comedian so bad, I fought through that fear. And then you start to tame it. When you do anything consistently over and over, you know, you start to master something and get better at it.
Well, I think be your own best friend is fairly good advice for anyone starting out. Tom, thank you so much for chatting about your first gig.
Dwayne, you're a good man. I love working with you whenever I come to Ireland, and hopefully I'll see you again over there before too long, my brother. Until I see you, will you try and be your own best friend?
I'll be my own best friend for sure. Cheers, Tom.
All right, my brother. Thank you.
Be your own best friend. Good advice now. Good advice in the before. Good advice in the after. Good mantra that we could all follow. To quote RuPaul, if you can't love yourself, how in the hell are you going to love anybody else? How about you start trying to love yourself by being your own best friend? Give yourself some advice. Cut yourself some slack. The world's going through a tough time. Easy to beat yourself up. Say no. You're doing a good job. Proud of you. Excited for the future. Can I borrow some cash? That's episode 16, season 2, episode 6, Tom Rhodes. Thanks so much for Tom Rhodes for being my guest. Go follow Tom at underscore Tom Rhodes. Go follow Tom and tell him that you're going to be your own best friend. He mentioned his album Around the World. Go check it out. It's available now on Amazon Music, iTunes Music, Spotify, Deezer, and much more. And I think he's still doing Tom Rhodes Radio, so you can get that at allthingscomedy.com. I've been Dwayne Dugan, the world famous podcaster. Follow me if you enjoy me at Dwayne Dugan on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, although the Facebook hasn't been updated in about 4 years. So follow me on Instagram and Twitter. Follow the podcast at My First Gig Pod to find out who next week's guest is. Before anybody else, go back and check out all the archives. James Acaster, Sean Walsh, Ardal Hanlon, Todd Barry, Stuart Goldsmith, Laura Lex, Catherine Bohart, many, many more at myfirstgigpod.com. Until next week, I've been Dwayne Dugan. This has been Kitty. Well, now she won't wake up. Come on, here. Say goodbye. Oh, that's a fuck off, not a goodbye. Okay, right. See you next week, guys. Doodles.
It's the My First Gig Podcast. Whoa.